Our feature guest is a scientist, award-winning author and filmmaker who, to some degree by accident, has become a world authority on penguins. Otago University zoologist Lloyd Spencer-Davis has written extensively on the behaviour and ecology of birds and mammals, and he'd originally planned to go to Antarctica to do work on seals, but fate intervened and instead he found himself entranced by the triumphs and tribulations of the lives of penguins, which, or whom, if you prefer, he refers to affectionately as failed fish. Lloyd Spencer-Davis is a former director of the world's first university course in natural history filmmaking, and he now directs the Centre for Science Communication at Otago. He's author of several books, including Looking for Darwin, a portrait of Darwin that also traces his own, that is Lloyd's own personal journey away from the church teachings of his childhood and into his search for his own kind of gods. Well, Lloyd Spencer-Davis joins us now in our Dunedin studio. Great to talk to you.
Good morning, Catherine.
You know, it's hard not to start with that part of the journey, if you don't mind. Before talking about penguins or science communication in the 21st century or anything else, that age-old journey from childhood religious practice or experience to an adult perception or concept or belief about God. And you've written yours began at 12. With what event?
Well, that was when I was being confirmed, actually, and I had been given quite a religious upbringing, not too strict, but at least I was a fairly frequent visitor to the nearby church several times a week. And I was being confirmed, and the vicar came in one evening at our confirmation classes where we practiced whatever we had to practice, and he was clearly drunk and fell over the pew, and I just remember thinking at the time, you know, this can't be. And I guess it was what really started me thinking about whether the word of God, or at least as it was espoused by that vicar, was really the infallible thing that I should be following.
And that search for anyone, and including for scientists who have to confront it and deal with the intellectual challenges of it as much as anyone else, and perhaps more so, the search isn't black and white. It's not God exists or God doesn't exist. It's not religious texts or historic texts or the inspired word of God. Was it a black and white search for you, or was it much more complicated?
It became complicated. I think when you're younger, you do tend to see things as fairly black and white. And so after that sort of misgivings I had about the church at that moment, I became a sort of rabid evolutionist in one sense. And then as I started to question, I guess, the world and the way science worked, I started to see things in shades of grey.
What difference did, or what role did Darwin in writing the book about Darwin play in clarifying your thinking on these things?
I think the thing that most struck me about Darwin and his writings is that it made sense, and it made sense of things that were otherwise hard to fathom, and particularly when you look at the relationship that is clearly evident between animals and plants, and you look at the other evidence that comes from the fossil records and our understanding of time and geology and so forth. It is one explanation that makes sense, and pretty much none of the other ones that I've looked at make much sense.
You write of him, no matter how dark the journey becomes, sitting just above the horizon like a personal North Star, has been Darwin. Because you can fall back on something that does make sense, something that at least is a very strong theory of things?
I think that's probably true, because I think I have wandered about and I've played around with all sorts of philosophies and beliefs and made my own journey, if you like. And always it comes back to what stacks up, what is supported by the evidence. And the remarkable thing is that Darwin existed in the 19th century. He didn't have access to all the modern technology and equipment and science that we have now, such as DNA and so forth. And yet the spirit, the basis of his theories still remain intact despite all that extra research that has taken place since then.
It's something that can drive a person quite mad until they reach some kind of agreement with themselves. What is the definition of madness? Trying to have two contradictory concepts in your mind at the same time. Where have you got on your journey with this? I mean, do you believe in God?
I think as a person, I, you know, Richard Dawkins would stand up and say, absolutely not. I've always been a little open because, you know, I am mad and I do have these contradictory things. You know, I get on an aeroplane and I say little prayers to myself, which is really stupid because I know that's not going to protect me. And yet I have a certain fear of flying that I have to overcome every time I get in an aircraft. And so I am a mess of contradictions, and I like to think there's some sort of scientific part or analytical part that can weigh up the evidence and at least look at that from the point of view of, Darwinism and our understanding of evolution by natural selection fits with the facts. But I don't like to criticize too much the notion that people who believe in God, that's inappropriate. Because I think the thing about science is that it's really good for explaining where we've come from in terms of, yes, you can understand the that sort of almost inevitable march, if you like, from single-celled animals up to multicellular animals and to, I wouldn't like to say necessarily humans are at the peak of that, but they're on one branch of that sort of evolutionary train. So you can see that the evidence for that is fairly strong. But when you go right back to the beginnings and to our understanding of how life and the universe began, things start to get very mysterious and very shaky. And it's not that I don't think that we will ever get to a point where, yeah, sure, I believe that science will come up with explanations that stand up. But at the same time, at the moment, you have to have a faith, a belief in that science will do that. And that's no different, really, to having a belief in some supreme being or designer.
Big Bang is by no means a simple concept. And also there's this whole issue of cosmic coincidence, of this perfect coincidence of circumstance that allowed life as we know it to begin, and by no means has that been explained in a way that satisfies, well, anyone really. Would you agree?
Oh, I think, you know, when you look at all the circumstances that are required for life to develop, then you can say, well, we've been remarkably lucky as a planet. But on the other hand, when you look at all the planets that exist in the universe and so forth, then it becomes almost a statistical sort of impossibility that there couldn't be other planets that would have similar circumstances.
It's making peace with your madness is a wonderful thing in many ways, isn't it? And perhaps the source of that madness is the not knowing and the being unable to prove, because science ultimately can only disprove. It can't really prove anything in the end, can it? Neither can religion, for that matter.
I think that's basically true, that science operates by refuting things, and it's at least one philosophy of science, and it's probably the one that we use most in the world in terms of the way we set up experiments and we try to test hypotheses and so forth. But at the same time, I think, you know, we are rational individuals, and as individuals, we weigh evidence, and so we at the end of the day, we all have to make our own, if you like, weighing of the evidence
and come to some sort of peace with what we do and what we don't know. When you,
I suspect, yeah.
When you headed to Antarctica the first time, as we said, you were planning to study seals. What happened to change your path of expertise?
Well, I didn't have any expertise at that stage, but I was hoping to get some. And I'd always been someone who'd wanted to, if you like, study the charismatic megafauna, the big animals. And I'd seen myself as sort of Gerald Durrell or David Attenborough when I was growing up. And so the opportunity to go to the Antarctic, which is something I really wanted to do, and to study seals was too great an opportunity to pass up. And so I went to the University of Canterbury. But unfortunately, between the time that the person who I was going to work with had suggested the particular topic and my coming there, the Americans had basically done that research in that time. So I was left with the situation where just a few weeks really before I had to go to the Antarctic, I either canned the opportunity or I came up with another study animal.
Hence the penguin.
Absolutely, yeah.
And are you glad that the penguin has become the focus of so much of your work? What fascinates you so about them?
Well, I wasn't at the time, but I certainly am now. And really, they've become, I guess, the defining part of my life. And I well remember when I went down there for the first time, and I hadn't even seen a penguin at that stage. And I arrived in the Antarctic and went out to this little place called Cape Bird where I was working. And it was very early in the season, so there were virtually no one there, and there were virtually no other forms of life there. And I remember I went out for a walk in the evening on that first night that I arrived, and there were four penguins had arrived to start breeding. And this is a colony that has like 60,000 birds in. And I encountered my first penguin, and just that first encounter was something that I guess really changed my life.
What happened?
We met on a beach, and we stood facing each other. And I guess that's one of the things about penguins, is that they're kind of like us in a way, but they just they carry themselves with a sort of grace and a sort of orneriness at the same time. And this little knee-high thing just looked at me like, you know, are you going to get out of my way? And we sat, you know, stood, facing each other for a little while until I did get out of its way.
They have personality.
They have personality. They definitely, as individuals, have personality. But I think they exude personality, penguins. And although I'm supposed to be a scientist and regard them as little black boxes, which I sort of do, black and white boxes, as an individual, I can't help but be sort of empathetic towards them.
You affectionately call them failed fish, I think. What do you mean?
Well, basically penguins, well, not basically, they are birds, but they're birds that have gone back into the water. They've given up flight, they've given up their wings in exchange for going back into the seas somewhere around about the time that the dinosaurs were all dying out, and there were lots of fish available in the sea for them and lots of food. And as a consequence, they've sort of turned back the evolutionary clock, or they've tried to. But the issue is that you can never, you know, go back in terms of history like that. You can never replay history exactly like that, not in an evolutionary sense. And so they were left with the, if you like, the things that made them birds, the fact that they were air breathers, so they couldn't be like fish again, that they had to lay eggs that had to be incubated on land. And this created a compromise for them. Yes, they could go back into the sea and become like fish again in one sense, but they were compromised. They had to live a life in two different worlds.
I was just thinking with the discussion about personality, we humans do probably anthropomorphise them more than most creatures, don't we, with the penguin suits and the strange strut and everything else.
Yes.
One of their great challenges is their sex lives, which, without going into too much detail, I think you draw great amusement from. What is it that is peculiar, successful or otherwise, about their mating and their reproduction?
That's a leading question.
Be careful here, because I've heard of your speeches and how frank you can get. They're not very good lovers, shall we say?
They're not as adept as perhaps one might think them to be. And in some senses, they reflect what humans do. I think that's what initially attracted us, and I say us meaning researchers on penguins, to the sex lives of penguins when we first got into them, was that that doesn't sound good. When we first got into studying them, we thought they were like other birds, that seabirds, where they were said to be monogamous and mate for life, and that just proved not to be the case. When you sat down and watched them, you found that it was like watching an episode of Shortland Street or something like that.
I remember a documentary, and this is from years ago. You know how things can stick in your mind. This is from maybe 20 years ago, about the female penguin.
It's probably one I made.
It probably was. And forgive me if I'm wrong about this, but the female penguin, she's got this lovely mate. He's a pretty good guy. He sits on the egg and helps out at home. Then he heads off to fish, and she's all over the colony trying to get access to some better genes just in case, and then goes home as if nothing's happened while he comes back with dinner. Is that accurate or inaccurate?
You know, that's... Perhaps your telling of it was a little embellished, but one of the things that a co-worker and I discovered was that the penguins actually engage in what we call extra pair copulations. And this had not been realized until we actually sat there like masochists and watched them 24 hours a day round the clock. And what often happens is with these adelie penguins is that the male will take the first incubation stint on the eggs while the female goes to see to feed. And before she goes away to feed, she will go and collect stones to shore up the nest, because basically they nest in scrapes on the ground which are lined with stones, and the stones prevent meltwater from snow from engulfing the eggs, if you like. So the stones are really important to the penguins, and in fact in some ways they're sort of the currency in the colony, because they get spread around and used for nests, and they're in short supply. And some females were actually going up to males and acting like they were going to solicit sex from them, or respond to the male's overtures for sex. And then just simply, when the male moved out of the nest so the female would normally sit in it, grabbing a stone and whipping it back to their own nest and their own partner. And on a few occasions, they actually did have sex with the male in exchange for the stone.
It's the power of documentary making, if accurately or otherwise. I can recall it 20 years later. They're not very physically well designed for on-land sex either, are they? Flippers and balance and those sorts of things, which has possibly caused you some amusement observing them over the years as well.
Catherine, you seem to want to talk about this more than I do. they're not, and that again is one of the compromises they've made, because their wings have been reduced to these stubby little flippers, and yet they have to still mate like a normal bird. So the male gets on the female's back and then sort of paddles his way down towards the rear end, and it's not uncommon for the males to fall off, or when they are ejaculating to miss their target area, so to speak. Now I feel I have gone too far.
Now you really have. I think we've covered it. What is it that they have taught us or taught you in these years studying them about not only their own environment and what's happening, but on broader questions of evolution or biology as well? What have you learned?
One of the things I've learned is just how plastic they are. And by plastic, I mean how they're able to respond to differences in their environment. We often think of the aspects of an animal being and again, this is somewhat of a contradiction with the idea that everything is sort of determined by evolution and genes and so forth. We often think of animals as being programmed by their genes, and particularly for an animal like, say, an adelie penguin to be adapted for a particular place. And yet, if you take the penguins and you change the conditions, you find that they change what they're doing. And we see that very much with penguins around New Zealand, like the little penguin. Penguins essentially have two sorts of broad lifestyles. They can either be inshore foragers or feeders, where they feed just a little distance from the colony, or they feed a long way away, what we call offshore feeders or foragers. And just that decision about whether they're an inshore feeder or an offshore feeder alters completely their lifestyle. And what you find is that with the little penguin, the little blue penguin that's so common around our beaches and so forth, that it can be either inshore or offshore depending what the conditions are. So that while they do have some sort of genetic input into what they do, that there's a certain degree of slop that's allowed, or responsiveness.
What of the Antarctic penguins and their environment? Is it stable, as we live in fear for those enormous blocks of ice at both poles? Is their stable environment, their environment stable?
Well, it depends where you're talking about in the Antarctic. Penguins, of course, are only found in the southern hemisphere, and on the Antarctic Peninsula side of the Antarctic, that's the bit below South America and so forth, the effects of global warming are being really felt, and the both there's a reduction in the amount of ice and ice cover, and also an increase in temperatures being experienced. And this is really changing or having an effect on the breeding biology of the penguins that are there. Whereas in the bit of Antarctica just below New Zealand, it's not so clear that those effects are being felt. In fact, the penguins below New Zealand are doing rather well. And although there have been some fairly dramatic events in the last few years, such as that major iceberg that got stranded off the penguin colonies and did have a cataclysmic effect on them. There's nothing to indicate that that per se was due to global warming, as opposed to just being a normal sort of event with an iceberg being formed.
Why do they not live in the north, in the Arctic regions, in the polar regions?
I'm sure they would if you could take them right up there. The thing about being a penguin, I said before, it was like a failed fish. Mm. They've gone back into the water, but they're warm-blooded. They require lots of energy, and so they need food that's found in great density, as you get in the Antarctic regions and indeed in the Arctic regions, where the seas are very productive and you get shoals of fish and swarms of krill and things like that. The problem for penguins is that if you get into the tropics, the seas are actually not very productive, and it's just not possible for them to sustain themselves, to get enough food to sustain that high energy that they need to maintain themselves.
And speaking with Lloyd Spencer Davis, he's an Otago University zoologist and also the head of science communications at Otago these days, also taught the world's first university course in natural history and has written many books. It's 27 past 10 on 9 to noon. You always wanted to write. How and when did you first indulge it?
It was probably, I have to cast my mind back, I think the early 1990s, and I decided that I would start to write a popular book about penguins, and started doing that, and took it to Barbara Larson, who was then at John McIndoe, and she must have seen something there that she liked, because she encouraged me to carry on.
Now at Longacre, I think, yeah?
Yes, Longacre and Random House, I think.
So you were writing for children initially, and finding a market for that, a keen market for that.
Actually, it wasn't for children initially. The first book I wrote, I did write from in a first-person point of view, so from the penguin's point of view, but it was actually written for adults, and it was published as such by Pavilion in the UK, but then Harcourt Brace thought that, this is the big company in the United States, thought that if you're writing a book about penguins in the first person voice and it has colourful pictures, then it must be for children. So their children's division brought it, and it was marketed as a children's book then.
And then there was Plight of the Penguin, which followed, which did win the Children's Book of the Year award. It, however, also intended for an older audience, right?
Well, it was intended for teenagers, I guess, which at the time did, and still does, I think, in the non-fiction category, cover the up to 18s in the Children's Book of the Year awards, but it was intended for teenagers and above, I guess, was the thing. Yeah.
Even before the writing, there was the documentary making, and this began, I think, with Gannett's way back in the 80s.
Exactly, yep. I was working for Ecology Division of what was then DSIR, and I'd had a long interest in gannets because I was brought up in Napier, and I used to be a wildlife, junior wildlife warden, I think we were called, and used to go out to Cape Kidnappers and tell the visitors about the gannets. And the head of DSIR was a guy called Kazimierz Wojcicki, who was more or less my mentor when I was going through university. And he'd been studying the gannets for 40 years, and I just happened to come along at the right time to tell them that they should be promoting what they're doing, and why don't we make a film about gannets.
You also linked up with the Natural History Unit at one point?
Well, in fact, as a result of that, because I never intended that when I said we should make a film about gannets that I should do it, but when I gave them a budget, they were appalled at how much a cameraman and sound operator made in those days, which was more than in one day than a scientist made in a week.
Gosh.
And I must say I had embellished my experience and credentials before I'd been talking to them about it, about my experience of making films, which at that stage had been carrying a tripod for a friend in Canada. And so they said to me, look, why don't you do it then? And I had the choice of either canning the idea or getting a camera out, as I did from Avalon, and learning how to put film in it and taking some footage myself. And I did that, and then took the footage down to the Natural History Unit of TVNZ And I must say they were rather kind because they looked at it and said, well, there's potential here. Why don't we give you a good cameraman and you can work with them? And so I ended up working with Paul Donovan and we made the film on gannets.
A later film about penguins, Meet the Real Penguins, won 12 international awards. And mentioning the Natural History Unit, we do seem to have world-leading natural history documentary and filmmakers in this country. Have we? Do we make the most of the talent and the opportunity we have?
Well, there's two answers to that. I mean, we certainly do have world-leading people here making natural history and wildlife and science documentaries. And NHNZ, which is based in Dunedin and it partners us at the Centre for Science Communication, is the second largest producer of factual filmmaking in the world. Whether we see that product on our television screens is another story, and I'm afraid that politics and all sorts of things interfere there. But in terms of the product being developed out of this country, I mean, we should be very proud. For example, at the Centre for Science Communication, our students produce films as their homework, if you like, and there's a big festival in Bristol, which is called Wild Screen, which is held every 2 years, and which is really the natural history wildlife forum in the world. And they have a newcomers award, which is for first-time filmmakers, but this includes people making their films for National Geographic and Discovery and so forth at several hundred thousand dollars. Our students making films for $1,000, $1,500 have won the award 4 years ago, finalist last time, and this next time, which is just coming up, we have two out of the three nominees in the finals are our students. So, and that partly reflects the teaching that comes from NHNZ and ourselves.
Mm. They just need somewhere to go, as you say, to get this work
Absolutely.
Screened.
Yeah.
The other key area, of course, you've mentioned already, which is the science communication role, which is even broader than teaching these skills. How did you find yourself branching into that?
It was really a sort of extended midlife crisis. I think I've had the longest midlife crisis of anyone I know.
It's quite productive, Lloyd.
the problem is that I found myself as a scientist working and at the university as a researcher and as a teacher of science, but finding that I needed another outlet, and I was doing that myself personally, and with the films and the books and so forth. And at a certain point, the opportunity came to branch out into filmmaking and then to take that further and say, well, let's try and popularise science in a major way and establish New Zealand's first Centre for Science Communication.
Popularising science, it's a phrase, and we then have to sit back and say, what does this mean? In some ways, is this almost a rerun of the advent of mass literacy? There were those who could read and those who couldn't, and it almost determined the social and in some ways the wealth divide. Are science and technology in some ways the new literacy and the new barrier to be crossed?
That's a really intriguing idea, Catherine. I hadn't thought of it exactly like that, but I think it's a very good analogy because we live in an increasingly technological, scientifically dominated world. And if we're going to live in that world productively and make, you know, sensible decisions about what we do in the future, we really have to understand the science. And it's an extraordinarily difficult thing to do if you're a lay person and you're not familiar with some of that science.
When you say popularize science, you mean what and how?
What I mean is to make the science readily understandable by someone without a scientific background necessarily, and to do more than that, really, to make it engaging, to make it entertaining, as well as being informative. Because the thing is, it's not enough just to simply put the science out in a digestible format, I don't know, in a PDF somewhere, because it just will get buried with all the other competing forms of information and entertainment that people have. So it's really behoves us now, if we want to get people interested in science, is to make it really exciting for them and also fun. And that's a big part of making science understandable for people is telling stories about science that they find engaging.
And what are the conduits? Because you just mentioned if broadcasters won't broadcast documentaries, well, they're quite happy to buy them up on the Discovery Channel, but if they won't broadcast documentaries here, what are the other means? What is the role of journalism and other conduits to the public?
Well, of course, there are the traditional forms of the media, the newspapers, the magazines, television, film, and so forth. I think, you know, it's what's really happening is that we are living in an internet-driven age and a digital age, and I actually find that really exciting. The future of publishing, and I mean publishing in the broadest sense, is being democratized, and I think that we can get out stories on science and so forth through the internet, through interactive things like the iPad, and that it's actually a very exciting future, I think.
And why does it matter? We've mentioned the technological basis now of just about every form of industry, and increasingly so. Are there bigger reasons why it matters that more people are more literate, whatever that means, scientifically?
Oh, well, I think it matters in the same way that it matters that we have a free press, because it so much of what we do, I can't think of a single thing that we do that is not in some way impacted by science. And we have to make decisions, and I say we meaning that we, the population, and by virtue of voting for politicians and so forth. And it would be very easy to have the wool pulled out over our eyes if we weren't able to understand the science and question the science that is both threatening to kill us all and wipe us out, but is also the potential saviour for us all in terms of if we do the right things. And it's taking those steps to develop the right sort of lifestyle and the right sort of future that we want for ourselves and our children and their children, that we can only do that. We can only make informed decisions if we understand science. And I really think it's important that we promote science to everyone.
What's happening with your graduates from the course? What are they doing with what they've learned?
They're going into all sorts of different things. We were audited a little while back, and we found that of the filmmaking, we exist as three streams. We have filmmakers, we have writers, and we have what we call pop sci's, or popularizing science students. And they go into all sorts of areas. But the filmmakers, about 80% of them were finding their first jobs in the industry, which was very good. Our writers, we've just started to, this program has only been running for 2.5 years now, and we've just had our first lot of graduates. And they're starting to find jobs in magazines and as writers. We have got our first lot of people through the popularizing science stream, and they're also going into areas like working for museums, Department of Conservation, that sort of thing.
As the midlife crisis continues then rather productively, do you have new plans, new dreams and schemes, or do you think you've got enough on the plate right now?
No, I always have new dreams and schemes, Catherine, much to everyone's worry, I suspect.
Are we allowed to know?
I've just got back from the United States, where we've been working on a little film about Ansel Adams that's sort of got me excited, and it's part of a bigger project looking at advocates for nature. So that's one area that I'm excited by. I've still got one book left in me on penguins, apparently. I'm getting pressure on me to write that, and it's sort of more of a memoir type thing. So I've started on that, and quite a lot of research going on in science communication itself. So it's a fairly full and fairly exciting future, but you know, not one without doubts and that madness that you spoke about at the beginning.
Where would we be without it? We wouldn't be searching, would we, Lloyd?
No, I'm always searching. In fact, I think searching should be my middle name rather than Spencer.
It's been lovely talking to you. Lloyd Spencer Davis, the Otago University zoologist, author of several books, Looking for Darwin, tells his story. It's a portrait of Darwin, but also tells the story of his influence on his own thinking in every way. and also, as we said, head of the Centre for Science Communications at Otago University.